Life is an endless stream of challenges, but no worries. Manoj is bringing the world's best minds right here for you.
My gosh, Manoj, you just blew my mind.
Thank you, universe. Manoj, thank you.
I'm so grateful.
It makes me feel a little bit better.
Thank you.
Bootstrapping Your Dreams is here to give you what you need to succeed.
Hello and welcome to this new episode of Bootstrapping Your Dreams show. I'm your host, Manoj Agarwal, and today we have a very special guest, Inderpal Bhandari. So Inderpal is the Global Chief Data Officer at IBM and leads the company's data strategy to ensure IBM remains number one AI and hybrid cloud provider for the enterprise. His expertise is in transforming data into corporate value and better customer experiences through strategic and innovative capabilities that leverage analytic insights to support growth and productivity. It's interesting that Inderpal worked at IBM as a research staff member till 1997 and rejoined IBM in 2015, bringing more than 20 years of leadership experience at leading companies such as Cambia Health Solutions and Express Scripts. At Cambia Health Solutions, Inderpal served as the Senior Vice President and Chief Data Officer, where he drove the development of the company's data strategy. Cambia Health Solution is working to create a person-focused and economically stable, sustainable healthcare system, and it employs more than 4,000 employees and reaches more than 70 million Americans nationwide. Before that, Inderpal was Vice President of Knowledge Solutions and Chief Data Officer at Express Scripts. Express Scripts employs more than 13,000 people and works to help 100 million people get stay healthy. He was selected as the CDO Club's 2017 U.S. Chief Data Officer of the Year, and he has been quoted as an industry expert by Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, U.S. News, World Report, CNN, and Fox. Moreover, Inderpal's business and technical contributions have appeared in both technical journals and popular media, and he has been invited to give keynote speeches at a number of prestigious conferences. And Inderpal studied electrical and computer engineering at Carnegie Mellon University, where he received his PhD in 1990, at University of Massachusetts, where he received his master's degree in 1985. Wow, that is a lot of great achievements. I'm so honored to have you on this podcast.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here, Manoj.
Awesome. So you've had such amazing success such an illustrious career. Can you help us, take us down the memory lane and tell us a little bit of your story? How did you get started in this line of business? How did you pick your career path?
No, so, you know, it's very interesting. I mean, I think, people say follow your passion and they give you all that kind of advice. I think mine is the flip side of that. It's the precise opposite of that. When I was in high school, growing up in India, my parents really wanted me to be a chartered accountant.
I see.
In fact, I was studying accounting in high school, and I was doing quite well in it, but I did not really find it very exciting. And but because I was focused on that field, I hadn't applied for all the different entrance exams to the IITs and all the prestigious engineering schools.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was one school, BITS Pilani, which didn't require an entrance exam at that point. And they just looked at your high school results and they admitted you. And they had this new field, electrical and electronics engineering.
I see.
So I just decided as a lark, why don't I apply? And I got in, and then, my parents, they had a family powwow and said, we haven't had an engineer in the family, let him do it, let's see where it goes.
Yeah.
And so, that's how I kind of got into the technical field.
I see.
And from there, it was more a question of finding challenging things to do. And, but that world opened up because the technical challenges, it was very challenging degree, right? The bachelor's degree was challenging. And then the opportunities to go and study in the U.S. as a graduate student, they opened up as well. And then, you could see that those challenges were also much more so in those days.
Yeah.
In terms of opportunities. So I came over as a grad student first to UMass, and I was chasing challenge again. So I went to went to Carnegie Mellon.
Yeah.
And even at Carnegie Mellon, it was another happenstance thing that started propelling me towards this direction. I was flying through my PhD, which was in VLSI, you know, very large scale design of chips and things like that. And maybe 2.5 years in, and then I ran into one of our very well-known professors of that time, a gentleman called Herbert Simon, who was a Nobel laureate in economics, Turing Award winner, father of AI. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened he wanted an engineering student for an AI thesis.
I see.
So I switched. I said, okay, I will. You know, I talked to my other advisor as well, my engineering advisor, Dan Zavoric, and who just retired from CME, by the way. He's still there, but he's an engineer's engineer. You know, he's a very accomplished engineer. And he said, yeah, if you can work with Herb, then, you know, that's going to be worth it. Take the extra time and do it. So I was one of the first, engineering AI theses out of Carnegie Mellon. But that got me into essentially analysis and analyzing things, much more of a piece. Still not data. It had to do with an AI type of thesis. It had to do with troubleshooting of computer boards, you know, using the same program to troubleshoot different computer boards, memory board, the input-output board, the processor board. So essentially showing that computers could exhibit general purpose troubleshooting behavior as opposed to the expert systems of that day, right? And then I was all set to go teach as a professor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but Herb Simon said, you know, I think that's a mistake. He said, I see two kinds of grad students, one who get their problems from by reading journals, and the other that actually get their problems by working on the domain.
Yeah.
Who are the latter? So it's a mistake for you to go to academia. You'd be better off in industry. And it just so happened that IBM was interviewing the next day, and I went there and I liked the Watson Research Center who were there. And you know, I got in there. Now, this is where it starts getting a bit more towards data. They were interested in me because they looked at the work that I'd done with computer boards and hardware, and they had a problem with software. They were releasing software programs, you know, massive operating systems, et cetera, program middleware, mainframes, et cetera. And when there were defects or bugs, it's very difficult because when you have millions of customers worldwide, difficult to recover. So they were looking at ways to arrest that, you know, in process as opposed to post release. And they thought my work was interesting and I could apply that. Mm-hmm. And I started looking at that problem and realized that you had to do something which the team did not already know, because the team already knows everything. If they think of a problem, they're going to fix it. And the way the defect data was analyzed at that time, it was analyzed by the quality control people outside of the team. And they would observe things in data, but they never had the basis to interpret it. So I came up with a program that allowed the team to directly analyze their data. But it had to be a data mining program. It couldn't be obvious stuff. So that got me into data mining at that time. And that was an extremely successful effort. That was what I would say, you know, that it succeeded beyond my expectations. There were many labs within IBM that started making use of it. Then the research folks said, okay, what are you going to do next? And I said, you know, I think the internet was just taking off in those days. So I said, I think that this data mining stuff can actually apply for all the lay people. You know, they will all use it. Mm-hmm. And they said, fine, you know, we don't understand this because, you know, we our customers are the big banks. They have whole back rooms of analysts. So we don't understand this. But, you know, you've done some good work. You're a researcher. We'll give you some freedom. Go off. You can do something with this. And I spent a bit of time trying to really articulate how to establish that point of view, that this is something that the lay user would use. And then one of my habits is I will pick up something that I don't know anything about and I'll read it end to end. just to force myself to pick up something new. And I picked up the New York Times educational supplement. I read that, and the last page, there was an article about how Pat Riley, who was the New York Knicks head coach, just been appointed, was creating a database.
I see.
And that gave me the idea that this could be something that really shows that the average person can make use of data mining software.
That's awesome.
So I ended up creating this program called Advanced Scout that ended up being used by every team in the
network. Wow, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, that then squarely got me into data mining and this whole field of data. So that was the journey. It was, you know, that's why I gave you the progression. It wasn't that I was passionate to begin with. It was circumstances, happenstance that kind of led me down that path. At some point, I became useful.
Mm-hmm.
I knew so much about the domain that I could actually help people.
Yeah.
And then your career path started taking.
That's an amazing story. Thanks for sharing. I think I picked up the three main insights which I want to reiterate. Like, one is that I think every successful person I meet, and you have that quality as well, like, you're open to possibilities. You know, you're not closed-minded. You're saying, okay, let's go with the flow. Let's see what happens, right? And then the other thing is seeking challenges, because when you seek the challenge, you go into the unknown, you learn something new, and then you grow out of it, you know? So that's another quality. And then the last thing, what you said about data, because I work with data myself, you know, I work with AI, and just like you, I'm also surprised when these technologies can surpass our expectation. Like, they are so powerful that as human mind, we cannot even fathom that this is the kind of result we will get, right?
Yes, so, no, absolutely. And I think that the you know, all three points you raised are really, really true, which is, one is kind of being open to possibilities. That's the learner's mindset, right? Otherwise, you can't learn. In fact, you open yourself up. Like, that's why I have that habit. Read something I've never read.
Through it,
you know, force myself to do it.
And then
getting out of the comfort zone, right, which is kind of the seeking challenges.
Exactly.
To do all that. So you're absolutely, you're right on. I mean, I think those are the main insights.
So now let's talk about, continue to talk about your journey. Like, you know, you faced so many challenges, you overcame them, but I'm sure you also made some mistakes, you know, which were the lessons that you may remember. So can you share some mistakes that were really good lessons for you in your journey?
Yeah, no. So, you know, it's what I've come to realize is that the mistakes are really just part of the process. So, in fact, I don't even really call them mistakes. I mean, they are what you end up doing is becoming better at managing the failure. But to some extent, you learn through the failure. So you kind of almost fail by design, and you learn to get better at the design so that it's not so rough that it terminates whatever effort you're on.
You're able to
fail fast, fail smart. You hear people talk about all these things, but it's really about creating an environment for yourself or for the people you manage, actually, that they are able to fail, without really losing their shirts.
That's
the key. So, there are so many examples of that. I mean, I kind of fail all the time, really, is how I like to put it. But I'll give you a couple of stories there that might help bring it home.
Yes.
And so, you know, when I did my startup, and that too was an interesting reason why kind of it went in that direction. I mean, once I did that Advanced Scout program, I recognized that I enjoyed the whole process, not just the research, but also the creation of the product, taking it to market, working with customers, you know, just the end to end.
Yeah.
And there was a bit of a disconnect there with my management at research at the time, where they didn't think that I was actually management material.
I see.
Quite literally. So you know, then that's why I left on very good terms. But that was my main reason for stepping out, was because I wanted to pursue the end-to-end process, and they wanted me to continue being a researcher. They thought I was very good at being a researcher, and I should continue to do that. And you know, that could have been a massive failure right there. You know, I was all set. They were pretty much letting me do everything. It could have been a mistake. You know, for some time it looked like it was a mistake, because I went out as a researcher with absolutely no experience with management, never done an MBA or, you know, or anything like that. No experience doing business, trying to make money, et cetera, et cetera. And so I had to learn all that on the job, right? That was my MBA on the street. And I potentially, you know, I think I made every mistake that one could think of. You know, I was not open to venture capital, for instance. I just thought that that was not a good thing, because they should not come in and get so much equity. And, you know, it was one of those things that I did not appreciate the value that potentially a good investor could bring. When I came out, there were many people who wanted to follow me out. You know, I had a bit of a following there. And but the ones that the ones I was receptive to follow me out were the other techies, mm-hmm. the business people.
Yeah.
That's who I should have partnered with. And once we got into it, it also, you know, it became clear that the customer is really right. No matter, you know, how good your software is, how smart you are, how elegant it is, eventually the customer is right.
Yeah.
That lesson also didn't sink in for really quite some time. You know, I mean, I think I must have ticked off plenty of potential customers.
Yeah.
Because I did not understand that simple and what is an obvious fact. And, you know, but we kept... So there are lots and lots of those examples, but kept doing this for 10 years. I mean, I ran that company for 10 years, and I keep telling everybody, you know, that this is something that if I have to do over again, I will not make those mistakes. But then I ran into one person who essentially knew me back then and gave me the example of another company that started around the same time that I did. You know, it's a company called Fractal. Mm-hmm. They started around the same time. They somehow stayed the course till now. They're now a unicorn.
I see.
He pointed out, he said, perhaps your biggest mistake that you didn't continue making your mistake.
Yeah.
And then that might have been, because all that stuff is still relevant. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think, you know, when I look back, that's how I tend to look at mistakes. You know, what seem like huge mistakes today, probably not. You won't look at it the same way tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, all these mistakes I made at Virtual Gold, running that company, it did qualify me to be an executive. You know, it trained me in management. That's what then allowed me to become a chief data officer. So, in the big picture, I think if you're making a full-hearted attempt to learn from all those mistakes, they're not really mistakes. I mean, that's what I would put forward.
Absolutely. No, those are great examples, and I relate to all of them. You know, coming from an engineering background, now being an entrepreneur, I had that same sort of mindset that, you know, venture capital is bad. I mean, the name of the show is Bootstrapping Your Dreams. So, you know, I come from the similar mindset, and also not listening to the customer initially, but then later on realizing technology is to serve the business, is to serve the customer. And one interesting point, you know, obviously learning and going through entrepreneurship journey is also a journey for self-discovery, you know, what you are made of, you know, what your capability is. But one important point you brought up was, you know, MBA. So in today's age, and this has been a topic all over the internet, in today's age, what do you think is the value of a degree to be able to do something, whether that's professional work or entrepreneurship or anything like that? There are a lot of debates about that. What is your opinion after spending this much time and being so successful in the business world?
Yeah, I mean, I think eventually it's the experience.
Yeah,
that's what eventually counts. And I'm a little, maybe a little biased in this, but that's why I think that the technology programs that are more hands-on, it doesn't mean that you have to go in and do all the coding yourself. I mean, at Carnegie Mellon, I did some coding, but eventually I was able to interest a very smart undergraduate student to implement most of my...
I see.
So, and you know, he got his credits and yeah. I got my work done much faster and I had a much bigger thesis. So, but it was hands-on. I mean, it was required. The school forced it. It's because when I kind of put my thesis idea forward, these computer boards, and they said, all right, so how are you going to demonstrate? You have to demonstrate. How are you going to, sit down and put in the design of all these chips and, and the board, how long that's going to take you? And they forced us to think through all that. And then eventually I said, okay, you know what? We're going to take the simulation for those boards and use that as the knowledge input. So it just put a whole different spin on it. It just becomes much more implied, much more experiential. And then you can go forward. Similarly, the MBAs, where they make you go through, just cases after cases of actual things that happened in various companies. I think, just think of it, right? If you spend 3 months and you go through 1,000 cases, that's got to be valuable. Is going to be valuable. You can't spend 3 months just getting all that experience. So I think it depends on how it's done. But yeah, a good education can be extremely valuable.
You are listening to Bootstrapping Your Dreams Show with Manoj Agarwal. Businesses face numerous challenges like finding the right product market fit, determining the market size, implementing a winning go-to-market strategy, crafting customer-centric USP, competitive analysis, looking for funding, building up cash flow and profitability. We have made a lot of free resources available to the entrepreneurial community, including this podcast. We invite you to check out our websites and follow us on social channels. The links are in the show notes. We hope you find the resources useful and utilize them to grow your business. We also have some programs for entrepreneurs. If you find our content useful, then you will definitely find the programs outstanding. So do check them out. Awesome. So, getting back to your journey, entrepreneurial journey, especially, how were you able to, and even in your role at IBM, I'm sure you have to differentiate yourself. When you were an entrepreneur, you had to differentiate your company. You had to explain what value you provide, and also with IBM, how to differentiate against the competitors. And I feel like that is one of the toughest challenges, especially for entrepreneurs. What are your views about it? How did you handle that?
Yeah, no, it's a very, very good point, and it's an extremely important lesson to learn, and it is not an obvious one. There are lots of fairly glib ideas that people say, hey, differentiate, come up with an extra feature, this and that. So I'll give you a story about from one of my jobs where, the company had, I was hired as chief data officer, in fact, the very first chief data officer in healthcare. And the company had come up with a different operational strategy. They were going to essentially... have these specialized pharmacies that only specialized in specific disease conditions. And the idea was that, let's say if somebody suffers from diabetes, then they will not only have their diabetes problems and need the blood sugar and insulin and all that stuff, but they'll have eye problems, foot problems. So if a pharmacist got a holistic view of what was going on there, they would be able to serve the patient better. Mm-hmm. And it's a great idea, and that they said, well, we're not getting any credit from Wall Street. And, data in the problem. This is, you got to prove this out. Now, when I started thinking about proving that out, it was very clear to me that, look, I kind of joined when they were halfway implementing this change. So there was a natural experiment. There were half the population was being served the old way, the other half the other way. So, my scientific mind said, natural experiment right here. We'll be able to prove it in 6 months.
Yeah.
Told everybody that, and we got some very good results. They said, let's go and talk to all our clients. Let's talk to the Wall Street agents that they didn't care. They said, well, yeah, but where's the business? How are you guys making money from this? Then we went to the clients. Clients said, great job. You've done a tremendous job, but this is what we pay you to do. So we're not going to pay you anything more. Eventually, long story short, we had to come up with a brand new product that actually leveraged that difference. And then, so the competitor could not actually produce that product. And then there was a value to the product that we made, evident, like in terms of saying, okay, if this doesn't work, we'll write you a check. So that's differentiation. When you're able to take some major difference and it manifests itself in a product, create actual value that the customer can see and experience, you're going to get differentiate. That's differentiation. At that point, you're able to get market share. You're able to win the customer over. All those things start happening. It's just not that you're doing something different. I mean, it eventually has to be something that you can sell.
Absolutely.
So there's that whole step there, which is a very complicated and involved step. It can be very, very difficult. And I think that's a lesson to learn, that you've got to go through that path to make sure that that difference is leveraged and exploited in the business.
Yes, and I think it's also a discovery in sort of our own capability to empathize with the customer and learn about their pain points and sort of address it through technology, and it needs a certain level of maturity, leads a certain level of disconnection from your own ego, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And so, in IBM's case, right, this job, the points you just made, that's what we eventually ended up using for differentiation. So the whole idea was that, IBM wanted to make money from cloud, AI, data. That was the strategy, business strategy. So my data strategy became one of, let's make IBM into an AI enterprise, mainly because we didn't understand what it exactly meant for an enterprise. We knew what AI means for a consumer, thanks to the likes of Amazon and Google suggesting things to you and auto-completing your searches, etc. But for an enterprise, what did it mean? So I proposed, look, as part of the data strategy, really what we'll do is we'll make IBM into an AI enterprise. And then, because our clients look like us, we will be able to share that with them in an experiential way. And then they will know what to do, and they will be able to buy it. So that process, really amounted to a level of pretty radical transparency in terms of being very transparent about all the pain points, where we were, what we were doing, how we were doing it, and so forth. But the clients, they appreciated that. They knew that, okay, we don't have a perfect solution, but they could see the path. They could see where we were going. And, and it was the best that anyone had anyway. So it wasn't like by putting all that forward, we were, doing anything to put off the customer. Actually, they welcomed it because they said, okay, we can make an informed decision as to whether we jump in now or maybe 6 months in your roadmap or, but they were totally engaged.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. Now let's talk about that. Now that we are talking about data and AI, you have a very unique vantage point. Like you are seeing the world from a very top level. So a lot of people ask me, hey, is AI going to take over the world? Is it going to destroy the world? What are your views about the future? How is AI going to transform our lives? I'm very hopeful about the future, but I'd love to hear about your thoughts.
Yeah, so in IBM, we kind of refer to AI not so much as artificial intelligence, but more as augmented intelligence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I will explain why. It actually goes back to my data mining days with the NBA. The first time that computer program. So what it did was it used to find these counterintuitive lineups that the coach could play in the playoff games, right? Because they were knockout stage, it was very critical. Yeah. So the first time it came up with a counterintuitive pattern, right? It basically said, play your backup point guard and your backup forward in your starting lineup. And, you know, putting benching your marquee players, really. And the coach called me and said, you know, if I do this, I'm already down 2-0 in the series. So I lose the game, I'm out of the series.
Yeah.
But I will probably lose my job. I will probably lose my career because people will be laughing at me all the time, right? So, and you can think about this now. I mean, if it's an AI program, if it is providing some kind of option, let's say it tells a surgeon, you have to amputate the left leg.
Yeah.
Surgeon is not going to say, okay, fine, do it.
Yeah.
He's going to know, okay, why? What are the options you considered?
Yeah.
What are your reasons? Why have you not considered other things, et cetera, et cetera? So the program has to be able to explain all that because eventually there's that decision maker.
Yeah.
And that's true of the vast majority of the enterprise applications. You're going to have somebody there as a decision maker who will want that kind of transparency and explanation to be able to do that. So if you think of it in that mindset, right? If you think of it in that mindset, yes, it's a different world. It basically becomes, you know, it's a tool now to make things more accurate, faster, more efficient, etc. But it still, you know, by the same token, has to provide even more powerful explanations and transparency than you would otherwise provide. That's where you have to take it. Otherwise, it will all blow up anyway from a business standpoint.
Because
you don't have the right level of trust.
Yes.
This is one of the reasons why it took us, you know, in 2011, we had a program that won Jeopardy. Watson won Jeopardy.
Yes, of course.
Okay, you know, so we were, from an algorithmic standpoint, we were at the top of the hill.
Yeah.
But from an enterprise standpoint, what we realize is the algorithm isn't everything. In fact, it's just one of the many things that you have to solve. Trust being the biggest one. And trust kind of comes in many different flavors. I mean, the program's got to be fair. It's got to be robust. It's got to be transparent. It's got to explain things. So it took us a while to kind of realize that and work towards that and take a platform approach towards that. I think the other side of that, from a people standpoint, is worth, you know, thinking about that. So if you think about, you know, how these AI programs, and just to go back to my NBA example, that'll kind of bring it home. So the way we solved it then, you know, when the coach raised these issues, was we took him to the video clips where those two players were on the court in the last two games. He was in it. He could totally understand, right? This guy
faster.
He makes the other point guard work too hard. He's tired. He can't, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So what we realize is you're missing the context with those data mining programs of two decades ago. Today's AI programs can actually process all the unstructured data as well. You know, video, audio, scene composition, et cetera, et cetera. So in a sense, they are able to provide those explanations, if you would, you know. So this is why I think the timing is now that these programs will be able to provide the type of rationale you need, the explanation you need, et cetera. But now flip over to the people side. If there's somebody, the decision maker, they have to be comfortable dealing with such a program.
Yeah.
They have to know how to do it. Right, they can't be uncomfortable with it. They have to be educated, trained, call it what you will. But if you don't prepare them, it's going to be a disaster because they are not going to be able to work with these programs. So it kind of behooves us to, you know, to bring everybody up to that level so that they are able to then. And so we spend a lot of time on the people aspect.
Of our
transformation, just because we have AI embedded in every major process.
So a
people aspect. I think also just from a, you know, a social point of view, again, people have to be educated and aware of these things. It takes me back to Benjamin Franklin, one of the founding fathers, right? He came up with libraries everywhere. That's why you have every neighborhood in the U.S. there's a public library.
Yes.
The reason he said that is because knowledge cannot just be in the hands of a few.
Exactly.
So this is the way to think about data, AI, these, you know, transforming technologies. Because you need the community, you need the people to shape it.
Yes.
So the literacy aspect is kind of critical.
Absolutely. I mean, it's in every point you're making, that theme of building technology with people aspect in mind is originating, and that's a very good point. Like, if you don't have the trust in these systems, they'll not be adopted or misused or not used at all. So that's awesome. Now, one of the last questions is you mentioned a few mentors that you had, but what other mentors did you have? Like, can you share some stories? How did they shape your life? How did they sort of steer you in the right direction? Because I find mentors in my life have made a huge, huge difference. So I'm sure that you have some interesting stories to share as well.
Yes. I mean, you know, mentors, I think I'm probably an extreme case when it comes to mentors, because I think that you learn so much from every interaction with everybody. I mean, it's like, so even, you know, Manu, this particular instance, and I'm reading up about you, I mean, I've realized, you know, Manoj must know a few things there that I think would be really good to understand. But even more than that, there's some stuff in Manoj's toolbox that I should kind of find out just how he approaches things. It's probably going to make a lot of sense. I mean, I'm an extreme case of mentorship in that very broad sense. I mean, obviously, you know, there are people, and I'm exposed to a lot of those people. You know, we have our CEO, Arvind Krishna. I have our head of HR, yes, Nicole Monroe. You know, my boss, James Cavanaugh. There are some very accomplished people that I run into. So many of our clients and customers are such, you know, high level. There's enough to learn from.
Absolutely.
Everybody. But the one thing that I've also realized is when you end up managing, an organization of some size, you kind of need to have your pulse on what's happening at every level. And one trick that I've used, I arrived at it over time, is to actually have, like, I obviously have my leaders that who report into me and so forth, who are, you know, the higher ranking executives and so forth. But I also have a shadow cabinet, if you
will. I see.
These are people who are non-executives, but they are chosen very carefully. There are three or four of them always. You've dealt with some of those in preparing for the show, mm-hmm. and I listen very carefully to everything that they have to say.
Yeah.
It's because otherwise you're going to miss out on things.
Absolutely.
There's also there's the groupthink phenomenon.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Which is also a kind of interesting point. There are many positives to having face-to-face, in-person types of meetings. But groupthink is actually a negative. You're going to get groupthink very quickly.
Yeah.
What I noticed during the pandemic is when you have, you know, the Zoom meetings, the groupthink is actually much harder to arrive at.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, I'm totally aware of that. Also, quite aware of my own shortcomings in many, you know, in many senses, right? So I'll deliberately surround myself with people like that who will help me. So in a sense, it's a broader view of mentorship. I try to take it beyond the, you know, just find one person here, one person there. You know, that's great.
That's a great example. Yeah, I mean, mentorship, I mean, as you said, we can learn from anywhere and everyone, we all have blind spots as well, and many people can see those blind spots no matter what their rank, status, or age is. So that's a great example. Thank you so much for sharing, and this has been such a insightful conversation, and very excited to have you once again. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Manoj. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Hey, I'm Sarah, producer of the Bootstrapping Your Dreams show. This episode has come to an end. Don't forget to check out the episode show notes for the links to the resources mentioned in this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Until the next episode, goodbye. Keep going and keep winning.